Okay, this is continuing with Helen Dotson Prince and Ruth Hedeman at Montreal on 20 August 1979. Now, we were at the point about you had gone up and seen Covington's data, he gave you his data. What things did you find about the centimeter waves?
It was much easier.
Why is that?
Because of the lack of the counterpart of noise storms and type 1 bursts floating around and type 3 bursts, the phenomena were primarily flare associated, so that when you saw an event, it was isolated.
Right, I see.
All right. And having had the experience of organizing the 200 megahertz data into early and late phenomena, we recognized the same thing in the 10 centimeter data.
Pretty much exactly the same sort of thing?
Or? No, it isn't exactly the same sort of thing, because there was never the occurrence of events that began long after flare maximum, the way there were at 200 mega, mm-hmm. at megahertz. It was a much tighter time relationship, wouldn't
I
you
see.
Say, Ruth? And practically all there were a few flares that didn't have 2800 megahertz, have something at 2800 megahertz, but very few. They were very inconspicuous flares. But again, you had the same pattern of some had an early burst, some had a late response, some had both early and late, and some few had nothing. So that it was a gratifying pattern that was emerging, mm-hmm. that essentially the flare pattern could be recognized at the two frequencies, although the records look very different and so forth.
Did you ever do a study where you looked at both radio frequencies for the same set of flares?
Absolutely. If you will look at our publications, mm-hmm. you will find these.
I didn't remember seeing it in the abstracts anyway, a mention of that. What did that reveal, any new aspects or?
No.
No, particularly?
No. They look very different because of the types of recording, but you will find that they are brought together in the articles. We took great pride in doing this because we did have the two records.
Another question is, with the 10 centimeter data, it was the first time I believe that you mentioned that you see some difference between when a flare is on the limb and when it's on the central meridian. In the occurrence, indicating some non-isotropy.
The second part is much stronger for flares near the central part of the disk than for flares near the limb.
The second type of flare, you mean?
Yes, the flares with the post-maximum.
Right.
The post-maximum burst at 2800 megahertz to us seemed to be greater when the flare was closer to the central meridian than when it was closer to the
limb. And did you take this to indicate that the radio emission was directed in some fashion? Or?
We left that to the radio astronomers.
I see. So you never,
we did, we
yourself,
we,
when
we
it
we
got
never
involved in the physics of
no,
the flare,
we,
not
we
in
left
the,
that to our radio astronomy colleagues. Right. We were doing the optical
What was going on in the sun.
The
All right, optical. Then we come to something that is not reflected in your set of...
This is only radio-related things. Here.
This is only radio-related is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
We had done 2800 megahertz flux, 200 megahertz flux, but the other source of solar information was 80 megahertz at Cambridge in England.
Oh, yes, I didn't get that.
I know, because we haven't published anything about it.
Well, if you didn't publish, how am I going to know about it?
We're telling you about it.
Right, that's why I'm doing these.
That covered...
What year is this now you're talking about?
1955.
So you wanted to go to yet a lower frequency to cover that?
We wanted to get a lower frequency.
Yeah.
We wanted to cover the range, and so we got in touch with Ryle and Hewish, and they were good enough to say, come over to the Cavendish. And so in the summer of 55, Ruth and I went over, and we were tucked up in the attic of the Cavendish Laboratory, and they brought out all of their records, and we brought out all of our...
Our flare lists
and light curves, and found that there was nothing too different. I mean, the pattern
from
200 megahertz, there was a tendency to emphasize the noise storm aspect, and it was their record, what, let me see, it had an interferometer.
Yes, you see, it was mostly an interferometer record, and so you had
the fringes.
Yes, so that it was.
Take that into account.
And we did not have a radio astronomer as a colleague. We had to plow through it ourselves, and we plowed through it enough to know that nothing was too different, so that we did not pursue it to the point of a publication.
And you didn't feel it was worthwhile to publish?
That's right. We didn't. I mean, it was an enjoyable summer's experience, but it wasn't something that we felt we needed to do anything.
Right, I see what you're saying.
We were busy doing other things.
But why is it that, I mean, there were many other solar optical astronomers of this time, and I don't know of any others that were as interested as you in correlating with radio emission. There were some that had some interest, but nobody that had this long, sustained interest. Do you have any idea why there was this attitude?
No, I have no idea why they weren't as interested in it as we were. It was the new thing, and we were interested. Maybe it's because new things were thought of at the McMatholder Observatory.
I think one. Well, do you have an idea?
Yeah. Yeah. But you are aware, are you not, that in the publication called the Quarterly Bulletin of Solar Activity, that they started publishing
in the late 40s. That's true.
Yeah, that's right.
Steve Smurd, of course, was very much involved in that. So that definitely indicated activity, but not to the extent of actually doing deep studies, such as you both did.
Maybe it was just a matter of personality. We enjoyed what we were doing. There was a certain satisfaction about finding something going on the sun that went with the radio events. Mm-hmm. That we enjoyed making that association.
Also, apparently,
interested in searching for something that would differentiate between flares that were geophysically effective in causing geomagnetic disturbances and those that were not.
Right. You got into that in the late 50s, it looks like, where you talked about the crochet flares and the geomagnetic indices.
Yes.
Did you find any good indicators? Up through the early 60s now, not going into later history.
We published something on major early bursts. This was before the identification of type 4 emission, and we had tried to associate type 2s. We had difficulties. Type 2s tended to be late, so that we didn't know what the major early bursts were. I'm not sure that I know now what they really were. Everybody wants to say that they were type 2 bursts. Maybe they were. We'll never know.
I see. These were these things that correlated with SC magnetic storms a couple days later.
Yes. Flares with only late type phenomena did not seem to be as effective. Am I not remembering correctly?
I don't remember.
I can check the papers on that, of course.
What has really evolved in later years, which you probably don't realize, is that we have evolved what is known as the Comprehensive Flare Index. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard the name.
All right. It is,
that's really all,
and you're familiar with the evaluation of flares, importance 1, 2, and 3, which is the H-alpha affair.
Right.
You're aware of all of the radio frequency things that go with flares. Now, we have evolved that which we call the Comprehensive Flare Index, which is based on 5 components.
Indicators of
5 indicators. The ionizing radiation, which is, if you are observing and can get it, is the X radiation. If not, you take what it does to the Earth's ionosphere and you evaluate it on a scale of 1 to 3. The H alpha, the optical observation, on a scale of 1 to 3.
Mm-hmm.
The 10 centimeter flux on a scale of
the logarithm of the flux. The dynamic
spectrum.
emphasizing the type 2 and type 4 by calling the type 4 a 3 and the type 2 a 1, and continuum kind of in between, we evaluated that as 2. So each one of these we tried to have a 1, 2, 3.
Then the last is meter wavelength radiation.
Right.
And what we have found is that the flares that are great in all of these aspects
mm-hmm.
are great in their geophysical aspects, and the flares that are missing in either one or the other can they sometimes miss in the
right.
geophysical aspects.
Now, when was this developed? Now, what year?
We have it's published as a UAG bulletin number 14.
What year?
Sometime in the 60s. We actually started compiling this index for our own use at the observatory years before that. And then
once you had some confidence,
NOAA asked us to submit it for a publication. Mm-hmm. And the first publication covered the years from 1955 to
1969, I think.
Yes.
So the basic details of your index were first published in the late 60s, then?
Somewhere in the 60s. I don't remember the exact
Or were they published in the 70s, Ruth? Maybe they were published
I can check that also.
It's UAG 14.
That's somewhat after my study is ending.
Yes,
it's interesting to know that this is
I mean, you ask us about...
This grew out of our interest in the combined radio astronomy data as well as the...
This is all precursor to that, if I may make a pun.
And we use this comprehensive flare index in our later work in evaluating the solar sources of the high energy events mm-hmm. in the neighborhood of the Earth. We also have a second UAG publication with this comprehensive flare index, which gives it for the later years. I mean, there are two of them in case you get mixed up in it.
Now, once again, confining ourselves to before 1960, are there any other major points about your work relative to radio solar activity that we haven't covered? I see that you correlated, for instance, 10-centimeter daily flux of calcium plage area
mm-hmm.
And some other things like that, but I guess these were side things that you were doing.
Yeah. There was that interesting paper that was that you and Covington published together after the big flares in May 1951, when he had an absorption effect in his record.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And showed that it was...
That's
We had a beautiful optical record to go with it.
Yes.
Which showed what?
All right. That showed that there was an ejection on the sun and it came out and covered the flare.
I see. And then that presumably was what absorbed the radio waves.
That's right. And that is published... That's one of the things that we published.
Another question is that most of the time you were dealing with low angular resolution data so that one only had the total radio flux from the sun. The only time that I've seen that you got involved with interferometric data is in this 52 paper where you had the Cornell interferometer and you correlated some positions in the radio with the optical.
I think that was at Covington's request,
Yes.
It would seem to me that would be sort of an important thing to do to follow this up some more, but you...
We used primarily time associations.
Right.
We were moving away from this when the high-resolution position work moved in. Others were...
You were moving away from... You mean when the Kalgoorlie came along and so forth?
It had... I mean, the association with what the sun was doing had been taken over by others. I mean, mm-hmm. the question that you asked in the beginning, why didn't others? Well, now others began to come into the field.
In the 60s.
We had been the pioneers, and so we were happy and content to let others who were closer to the radio astronomers
mm-hmm.
than we were. We've always felt that you needed to have an expert in the associated field if you were going to do something
mm-hmm.
in the field. Don't meddle in what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only other thing I think I would ask you is, what do you think is the main thing that radio astronomy, or the main things that radio astronomy has told us about the sun, once again, confining ourselves to pre-1960, did it really show us a new sun, or was it really only an extension of what we had known from optical work?
Well, it let us have information about what was going on in the corona mm-hmm. of the sun, to which we had no access prior to the radio astronomy days, except at times of eclipse and so forth, which were rare indeed. Right. So that it opened up a whole new avenue of phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
It was adding a new right hand. Yes, we'd hardly know how to get along. We haven't had to study the sun without the benefit of radio frequency data.
Well, that's true. Well, when you first started, you didn't have it anyway.
When we first started, but I mean, it really wasn't until after World War II that at least Ruth and I began working together. And by that time, you see, it was one of the first things that we did was to get involved mm-hmm. in the radio frequency data, and we always had access to it from then on out.
Right, right. I see what you mean. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, it is our pleasure.
That ends the interview with Helen Dodson Prince and a little bit of Ruth Hedeman, also in there at Montreal in the IAU, 20 August 1979.